This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Composer Philip Glass turned 75 today. His birthday is being celebrated with festivals and performances around the globe and the premiere of his Ninth Symphony tonight at Carnegie Hall. Glass is one of the founders of minimalism and easily the most famous composer of his generation. How many others have received commissions from the Metropolitan Opera and inspired a knock-knock joke? The punchline? Endless repetition. Repetition has been good to Philip Glass. He began playing works to tiny, often hostile audiences back in the 1960s. Since then, he's achieved an almost dizzying output of operas, symphonies, and works for his own ensemble. His collaborations with filmmakers and other artists have brought contemporary concert music to wide audiences, not to mention fans of public radio's This American Life. We're listening to a piece from Songs and Poems for Cello, written by Philip Glass for his current muse and companion, cellist Wendy Sutter. We spoke with Glass just before he and Sutter and Mick Rossi performed at Dartmouth Hop Center and then at the Portsmouth Music Hall. We asked Philip Glass about his many collaborations and why so much of his career has been spent working with others.
To put it very precisely, I find the other artists, I find them inspiring. If it's a dancer, for example, or a painter or a writer, the encounter that happens between me and their work produces ideas in me that are new, that I haven't been able to generate on my own. So I look outside of myself in a certain way for this kind of an engine of change that will keep me in working in fresh ways and doing things I haven't done before. For example, the songs and poems that you've just been playing on the radio, I just heard a little bit of it. I wrote it about 2 years ago. If I hadn't met Wendy Sutter, and if she hadn't been such a fine cellist, I never would have written that piece. And that piece has opened a very unexpected door for me, a door that leads much more into the world of classical chamber music. And since then I've written a sonata for violin and piano for Maria Bachmann, as another a fine player. I've written a piece for a piano four hands. So that one encounter has produced a whole line of new works that I never would have entered had it not been for that.
Well, so it triggered a lot from you, but it also is a very special collection, very well reviewed. And you also became attached to Wendy Sutter romantically after that. And I read one reviewer with the headline, "Philip Glass is in love."
Well, I've probably been in love all my life with one thing or another, music or people or children or...
But is it rare to reveal so much emotion? I mean, can people read that so easily?
I don't know. It's actually quite common, really, isn't it? I mean, we see it all around us.
I hope so.
We do, you know. And there are different forms of it, and it's different. I mean, it's one of the things that makes life rich and rewarding, and it would be a very lonely existence indeed, wouldn't it, if we didn't have these kinds of things. So what I'm doing is actually no different than what anyone does. But I stand out in the front from the crowd in a certain way because of the music making, because I'm a performer. And so you tend to focus on that. But in fact, it's a wonderful, but in many ways, a rather ordinary experience.
Well, you just mentioned that you perform as well as compose. Something somewhat rare, actually. Does playing the music yourself actually change your approach to composition?
Oh, sure. It does. I've had an encounter with the public, so to speak, in a professional way for 40 years, and I actually began playing in public when I was 10 years old, so it was close to 70 years. I've never been without that connection, so that I'm very aware of who the music is for. I mean, the music is not for the muse and the gods of music. The music is for other people. I consider music a very eloquent, perhaps the most eloquent language that human beings have evolved. We share it actually with birds and fish and other creatures, but for us, music as a language is the most intimate and expressive. Now, a dancer might say it was dance, a painter might say it was visual arts, and you know, other people would have a different answer, but that's my answer. And because I'm in front of an audience so much, I'm totally aware of how that transaction is working.
Well, and one way that you have reached so many is through collaborations with filmmakers.
Well, film was a surprise for me. I started late, kind of late for a composer. I was in my 40s when I began writing film music. And I discovered immediately that my audience had increased by several decimal points. From maybe there would have been 20 or 30,000 people who knew my music, it turned into millions of people.
That's the power of film.
That's the power.
And working with Scorsese, Errol Morris, Woody Allen, we're hearing right now from Nakoikatsi, if I'm pronouncing that right.
That's right.
The Watchmen now out in theaters. Mm-hmm. I wonder, do you watch finished films first or respond to the dailies?
What I try to do, I don't succeed that often. I like to work with the filmmaker when they're making the film. I think at that moment, I did that with Scorsese. I did it with the two other gentlemen that you talked about, Errol Morris and
Woody Allen,
and Garfield Reggio. But that is an unusual. Those are unusual people. Most films are completed and the music is added afterwards. I consider that a lesser form of collaboration because there's no give and take that way. But it does happen. The Hours was not completely done, but there were still several months of editing to do when I was working on it. So there was still a chance for us to interact, for me to interact with the director and the picture editor. But it wasn't as if I had. Well, I'm working with a filmmaker now, right now, Bernard Rose, and I have been sending him music while he was filming it, and he is using the ideas I sent him for the editing process.
Real collaboration.
That's the ideal, and it doesn't come up that much. I've done quite a few films, and I've been able to do it maybe 8 or 10 times, but I've probably, at this point, written 30 film scores, so it's the lesser amount.
Well, the director, Scott Hicks, he directed the film Shine, by the way, made a documentary about you called Glass, A Portrait of Philip in 12 Parts. You spoke in the film, actually it aired on PBS's American Master series last week, by the way. You spoke in the film about the importance of discipline in your work. What is the balance of discipline and inspiration in your creative process?
Well, I think discipline is by far more important than the inspiration. I mean, inspiration is a wonderful thing, but without the ability, let's say, without the stamina and commitment to sit down and work for 8 hours straight and do that maybe 100 days in a row, the opera's not going to happen. I'll just be a dreamer like many of us. We dream about doing things that I dreamed of when I was younger. I wished I had been a painter. I wanted to paint. I never could. Never had the time to learn it. But I loved the idea of painting, and I never did it. But I found my way to music, and that became what I've done. But the ability. It's not just artists who do that. I mean, working people do that. They go to work every day, and they work 8 or 10. Well, I would guess that very few people with day jobs put in the time that artists do in their work, whether they're painters or musicians or dancers. The amount of stamina and sheer dedication is enormous because the stakes are high and the effort is required, and there's no way to get around it. I do consider that very important. Inspiration is something which many of us have, and we see it in children, for example. If you are around children or not, you find they're painters and writers and dancers. Have you noticed that?
Of course, and somehow it gets flogged out of us. I don't know quite how.
Yes, I have a little boy now who's 7, and he's playing the piano very well. Now, before I took him to school this morning, we went into the music room, and he played through a Suzuki book of piano pieces he was doing, and we were 5 minutes late for school, and I thought, well, you know, hell with it. I'd rather be 5 minutes late for school and let him play the piano for me, and he's now getting into this, you know. That happens, in other words, when you're very young. And it happened for me when I was young. I began, that kind of discipline happens at an early age very easily. I have an older son who's a songwriter, Zach Glass, and he began when he was young. When you begin those habits, let's call them a habit rather than discipline. When the habit of work comes to you when you're young, it can last your lifetime, and it makes a huge difference in your life.
Well, you have worked with a lot of young artists and continue to. Are you hopeful about the future of classical
composition?
Good.
Extremely hopeful, and especially now. This is an odd thing to say. The downturn of our economy is going to be a great benefit for artists because instead of working for the marketplace, there is no marketplace. They'll be working for themselves. And we'll be back to the time when instead of having careers, we had vocations. And I've already seen that with young people who go into dance and painting and poetry and music and theater. They do it out of passion. They can be sidetracked into the economic benefits, into success, into careers. But they start out of love. And the fact that the rewards have been muted somewhat lately, I think is going to be a good thing. The 50s, when I was a young guy, were not were difficult times for many of us. 50s and 60s, we didn't have any money, but it was a very creative time. So, and I'm finding that the young generation, they have skills that we didn't have.
Well, they have technologies. I'm just wondering what you think of.
Getting into that, they have computer skills. That a young guy or a young man or woman getting out of music school now can play the piano, can work on the computer. They're things that are actually quite difficult for me to do. I can't do.
Well, do you think, you know, internet connectivity and, say, playing GarageBand is going to change the future of composition?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. No, it doesn't mean it'll be, you know, technology doesn't really make things better. It just makes them different. I mean, people were writing, Bach was writing wonderful music before there was a real, before there was a proper grand piano to play the music on. And the music was played on harpsichords and little pianofortes, and, you know, as time went on, the instruments got better. I saw a piano once that Chopin had written for. You can't imagine a tiny little thing. Made this a very sweet little sound, but you can't imagine the Chopin that you know being played on that music. But so the art doesn't really change, but the other factors come in, and it can be a real blessing for us.
Well, we have a lot of questions from listeners. I'm sorry that we don't have time to get to them, but one is the music composed in the past 50 years. Of that music, what do you predict will be heard in live performance in concert halls 100 years from now?
You know, that's a funny question, because we're not going to be around, so maybe it's really an academic question. But what I find interesting is that the pieces of mind that are being that are staying in the repertoire tend to be the big operas.
Yeah.
And now you say, well, is opera going away? I don't think so. Opera it turns out to be a very viable and enduring form. It's been going over for 400 years, and the copyist who copies my operas tells me he's busy all the time.
Prolific composer Philip Glass speaking with us in 2009. Today is his 75th birthday. His Ninth Symphony premieres tonight at Carnegie Hall and will be performed by the same ensemble that introduced his first mature orchestra piece 25 years ago. You can find more about the life and work of cabbie-turned-composer Philip Glass at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for listening. Segments and links from today's stories are available as audio at our website or as podcasts. And as always, we welcome your ideas, your comments, your feedback in all formats and mediums, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, email, or even the old-fashioned post. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please do join us again tomorrow at noon for more new ideas here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan the man runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.